Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Sanjay Torre, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And this is going to be a fun one. We've got a couple of recovering attorneys.
Yeah.
We've got a big shot at Deloitte. Talk about diversity.
Yep. It's a full house.
A full house. Got some PR people. But you know, next week, we got a busy week. We're going to be at FinTech South, broadcasting there to talk about all of the interesting things in financial technology firms are doing here in Georgia and all over the world. And Stone and I are heading to Phoenix for the Conscious Capitalism National Conference, and we'll be reporting from there as well. So you're going to hold down the fort?
I am.
We're excited about it, but not as excited as what we got going on right now. First up on Atlanta Business Radio, I got Avery Munnings with Deloitte. Welcome, Avery.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're here to talk about an interesting report that Deloitte put together about diversity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the report is called the Missing Pieces Report, and it's a collaboration between Deloitte and the Alliance for Board Diversity. And the report really focuses on spotlighting the diversity of corporate boards, specifically focused on both the Fortune 100 and the Fortune 500.
And then when they say diversity, what are they looking for diversity, and what groups are they counting as part of diversity?
Yeah, so it's really looking at both women and minorities on the boards, and just looking at the makeup of the board compared to those groups vis-a-vis Caucasian men.
Okay, so it's white men, and then it's everybody else?
I wouldn't say it's everybody else. I think it's white men, and specifically trying to understand the makeup of boards via women and minorities, and there are specific categories that are looked at within those groups. And so, you know, it's both people of color as well as women in general.
And so they didn't do sexuality. Gay, yeah. Straight, that wasn't part of this?
That was not part of it.
And then, so what was the results? Has there been progress, or is this a slow road?
Well, there has been what I would describe as significant progress, but I would tell you the progress has not been fast enough. And to put that in perspective for you, what we saw, the census looked at the diversity of corporate boards, as we've talked about it, for both 2016 and then again in 2018. And what we saw was in that period of time, we saw that the percentage of diverse people on the Fortune 500 boards, for example, increased from about 30% to 34%. You compare that in the Fortune 100, that increase went up to 38%. However, when you break the numbers down a little further, what you see is if you specifically look at African-American men and women, you'll see that that percentage only moved from about 12% to 16%. And you look at Asian and Pacific Island minorities, it's even less. And of course, with Hispanics, it's less. And so the point being, we've seen an increase overall in diversity on boards, primarily driven by the proportion of white women coming onto corporate boards. And then as well, we saw African-American women increase as well. But when you look at the pace of change and the pace of increase, it's actually not very fast at all.
And then how do you determine what's the appropriate pace of change?
Well, you know, that's really a subjective determination. What I would tell you is, you know, if you kind of step back and look at what's going on in the broader population, right, what we're seeing is a shift in the population in terms of the overall percentage of our population that's comprised of these minority groups. And if you look at the shift in the population, not only in terms of the percentage of women, but the percentage of minorities, you're not seeing the representation on corporate boards move in line with the shifting in the overall population.
And then does Deloitte have any suggestions, recommendations?
Well, what I would say is, you know, there is a clear business case to be made that more diverse corporate boards are not only good for business, but, you know, the right thing to do. But it's not about the right thing to do. It's really about there's a strong business case for it. And that is evident in a research study, for example, that was done by I think it was there are a number of data sources actually that illustrate that diverse corporate boards yield a positive impact on a company's market share. So specifically, companies with market cap of $10 billion with women board members outperformed comparable businesses with all male boards by 26% over a six-year period from 2012 forward, according to a Credit Suisse Research Institute study. And so just think about that, right? If you want to make the business case, if you've got women on your board and they're outperforming comparable companies by 26%, that makes a fairly strong case that there is value, real value, in diversifying corporate boards.
So now you're involved with lots of companies of size like this, and you make this case. And if they're purposely not doing that, then what would be the reason? If that's what they're charged for doing is to improving shareholder value, and they're saying, hey, yeah, I've read this research that says that we're going to get a better return if we do this, we choose not to do this.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say companies are purposefully not doing it.
Well, I think they're accidentally not doing it?
Well, I think is they need to be more intentional about achieving the result of a more diverse board. It's not going to happen by itself. You know, you have to have leadership of the board and the chief, leadership of the enterprise itself that are focused on achieving that end result. And so, and that means you've got to do things differently. You've got to seek out, you know, women and minority board members. You know, as vacancies come up, you don't just, you know, do it the way that it's been done for, you know, all of history, which is, you know, people know other people and they look to the same group of folks, and those same folks continue to populate boards.
Right. Well, there's inertia to that, right? Yeah. Like that's the white guys in charge of stuff by and large, and his buddies are white guys.
Right.
So when it's time to fill a slot, the pool he's looking at are primarily people that look like him.
That's right. As an example of that, for you know, when you look at the makeup of board chairs within the Fortune 500 companies, 91% of board chairs are white men. And, you know, that's not to say that's a bad thing. It's just to say that a function of that demographic is simply that you've got people in the leadership roles who are driving those decisions, and therefore it's easy to pull from, you know, folks you know and people you're comfortable with. You've got to be intentional about going outside of the places where you typically might look and to go and find, you know, those diverse board members. And as I said, it's not going to happen, by itself. There's got to be specific strategy around it, for example. Companies should look to, when board vacancies come up, going to search firms that specialize in finding diverse board members and, have specific objectives around filling those open seats with intentionality around the candidates that you bring. And so it's just a matter of changing focus and being intentional, and I think, you know, those results can be achieved.
Now, does it start, does the change begin with the CEOs or does it begin with the chairman of the board? Who is the driver here that can institute the most kind of action? Who's the best catalyst to make this change?
Well, quite honestly, it's all of them. You know, the CEO is a very powerful voice, you know, in the boardroom. And in many cases, if not most, the CEO also serves in the role of chairman of the board. And so if you've got that duality whereby you've got the chairman of the board also serving as the CEO, then that person in that role is very, very significant to that decision-making process. In other cases, you've got where the CEO might be the chairman, you've got someone called the lead director, right? And so you've got the lead director, which is intended to be an independent board member, not an insider like a CEO might be. And so the lead director then plays a key role in driving that result in combination, in collaboration with the CEO or the chairman of the board. And so it really comes down to the leadership either as board chair, and as I said, that could be the CEO, but the lead director also has a very key role in driving that decision.
And then is part of the challenge also is having the pool of candidates to be the board members to be more diverse too. Like it has to flow downstream as well, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the things that the study, the Missing Pieces report uncovered, is that even when companies are looking for diverse board members, women and minorities, what we see is that you've got the same candidates being recycled
on usual
different
suspects.
Boards. It's the usual suspects, right? So you find a small pool and you see those same individuals then being recruited time and time again by multiple companies to fill open board spots. And so what companies, again, have to be intentional about doing is going outside of those recycled board members to find new candidates in new places and bring them to the board. You know, one of the things that Deloitte has focused on in terms of the role we play is we have a number of board development activities that our firm has promoted and engaged in. We, just as an example, we have a world-class training and development facility in Dallas that we call Deloitte University. And what we do at Deloitte University is we have a number of targeted seminars and leadership development opportunities that we make available to corporations and boards, for that matter, to help them think through strategic issues like, you know, how do I make my board more diverse? Or just how do you get better collaboration, you know, on the board, and how do you achieve the objectives that the board intends that it wants to? And so we have developed over, you know, a period of years, tremendous capability and around, you know, assisting boards and companies with doing, you know, this work.
Now, is there any training to kind of groom a person to be a good board member, to have the skills and that you need to be a board member that is chosen to be part of the pool so that you have a chance to be chosen to be part of the board?
You know, there are multiple vehicles out there in terms of training that's available to potential board candidates. Some of them are available through firms like mine, but there are a tremendous number of them out there. You know, I would say the best and what most companies look for in candidates for the board are people who have had experiences running companies or serving in key C-suite roles. If you look at most boards of directors, they're made up of C-suite executives, former or current sitting CEOs, CFOs, chief operating officers, chief marketing officers, chief technology offices, and the like. And so, you know, the experience that one garners from having run a business or run a part of a business and have gained the experience in those roles is where most companies look to for board candidates. And you might, you know, think about that and say, well, that creates a challenge, because then that means if you're looking for women and minority
right, they're
candidates. Right,
they're running money less.
That's right.
So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's right. So again, comes back to the CEO and the board being intentional about making sure that when you look at the pipeline within corporations, right, that the candidates who are in the roles that they ultimately can graduate to the C-suite are diverse. And so it really starts from the bottom all the way up to the top, where companies have to be intentional about making sure opportunities are available across their organizations such that women and minorities are positioned to excel and to move up. And therefore, you create, over the long term, the candidates that ultimately become the diverse board members.
So you've been with Deloitte for a minute or two, and you've seen some things. Are you optimistic, pessimistic, realistic? What's your take on this situation?
Well, yeah, I've been with Deloitte for 32 years, and so I've seen a lot over that period of time. And I would say I'm optimistic. One of the things that this Missing Pieces study found, and in fact predicts, is that by 2024, our prediction is that you would have 40% of the Fortune companies having diverse boards and diverse or having at least 40% diversity on their boards, I should say, in the Fortune 500. And so if you think about that, that's huge. Today, as I mentioned before, the Fortune 100 is about 38%. And the Fortune 500 is only at about 34%. And so to move, you know, by 2024 to 40%, you know, is significant progress and also representative of a fairly significant move in the right direction.
Now, are you seeing diversity in the C-suite in the companies that are, you know, Fortune 501 and below? Are you seeing an influx of diverse leaders starting and running companies that aren't at the Fortune 500 level, but are still, you know, kind of growing and on the upswing?
Well, our study focused Fortune 500, and of course, the 100 is a subset of that. And so we have not studied level specifically.
But you've been around the block. So where are you seeing more diversity in up-and-coming companies?
I would tell you that the Fortune...
Anecdotally.
Yeah, the Fortune companies are doing better than companies that are smaller in size and scale than they are. So I don't have exact data on that, but perception-wise, I would tell you, from what I see, I would say companies below that level are not doing as well in their board diversity as you see in the large board.
But that's a problem, because they're kind of the farm league, right? Those Fortune 1000 companies are going to be in the Fortune 500,
some of them will.
Because the Fortune 500 isn't a static list.
Correct. It does change.
And it changes dramatically. If you want to look at the Fortune 500 from 30 years ago when you started, I guarantee you it doesn't look anything like the Fortune 500 of today.
Absolutely not. But I think what we have seen and what this study proves is that once companies make it into the Fortune listing, they are much more intentional about ensuring they've got more diversity than when perhaps they're not in that group. And so, you know, you're right. You know, the farm system is, as you describe it, what it is. And but certainly what we know is once companies get to that level, then in fact they are making a difference in achieving more diverse boards.
And when they see that these kind of reports come out and they see the ROI in doing this, maybe that'll kind of turn the light on in their shop.
Well, that's
well.
Our hope. I mean, that's our hope, is that, you know, research studies like this would demonstrate to companies that, you know, this is a business imperative to achieve more diversity on corporate boards. And there are a number of statistics that prove when you have more diverse boards, not only is it good for business, but it drives better operating performance within the company, and you know, overall, clearly demonstrates that the ROI of investing in more diverse candidates and more diverse boards is without question.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today. If somebody wants to get a hold of the report, what's the best way to do it?
Actually, if you go to www.deloitte.com, it will be available.
And then the name of the report again is?
It's called the Missing Pieces
Report. Missing Pieces Report on the Deloitte website. Well, thank you, Avery, for sharing your story.
Thanks for having us.
Hang with us. We've got a couple more guests. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Akilah McConnell with Unexpected Atlanta Walking Tours. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel like you timed this perfectly since a minority woman-owned
running
business.
There you go. So. Changing the world. So tell us your story. Tell us about the walking tours. How are you serving folks?
So, well, I can tell you a little bit about my story, and then I'll tell you about my business. So about 15 years ago, radio changed my life. I actually was an attorney. I was in Atlanta. I used to drive from my house into work every single day practicing environmental law. And I mean, what do you do in Atlanta? You're stuck in traffic, right? And so I used to listen to the radio. And one day this woman comes on, and she's on the radio, and she's talking about how she quit her job to travel around the world. And I went home that evening, and I told my husband, this is what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. And I have a very, very kind husband who was like, yeah, this sounds awesome. And so at age 30, I quit my job. The plan was we would travel for about 6 months. But 1 month in, I discovered that people would pay me to write about my travels and food. And so I transformed into a food and travel writer. And, you know, when I travel, I don't know if you do this, Lee, but when I travel, I love taking tours. You can, of course, go and experience the city on your own, but there's something so magical about having a local show you around.
Right, like a passionate Sherpa.
Exactly. Like a passionate Sherpa. But, you know, the amazing thing is that especially in a city like Atlanta, which is a somewhat newer city in comparison to a place like Boston or Philadelphia, you kind of look around and you're like, oh, okay, well, that's a glass building. But then
there's a mall.
There's a mall, exactly. But if you have a guide who can tell you that this glass building was where Martin Luther King Jr. was first arrested, that's so much more powerful.
Right.
So 5 years ago, my husband and I, we moved back to Atlanta because I found out I was having a baby. And, well, everybody knows kids change everything, mm-hmm. right? And if I couldn't travel, I thought, well, why not introduce travelers to my own city? And that is how Unexpected Atlanta Walking Tours was formed.
So now there's a hunger, I would think, out there for this more kind of experience-driven life, right? And young people today especially trade stuff for experiences all day long.
Absolutely. You know, the baby boomer generation was all about acquiring
stuff,
goods.
Right.
And now Gen X and the millennials are all about getting rid of all of this mm-hmm. stuff and instead doing experiences. And we've really tapped into that market. When I launched this company 4 years ago, at the time, there was no food tour company in the city of Atlanta. And we have, in the last 4 years, quintupled in size. Every year, we have doubled in size that we've been in business. And that's simply because...
Because you have a diverse board.
Well, we do. We do, in fact, actually. We are actually... What's funny is I have tried so hard to get men to join our organization. Right now, I have 8 guides, one operation manager, and me, and we're all women. We're very diverse, actually. We have women of all different races, and we have tried so hard to recruit men, and they don't want to join us. So they're missing out.
I'm going to help you find some men to join, because I think what you're doing is wonderful. So tell us about some of the tours that you are kind of putting on for folks.
Sure. So first off, have you ever taken a food tour or heard of a food tour?
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Buford Highway. So if you have Buford Highway food tours, I'm in.
Well, actually, Buford Highway is in the works. So a food tour is basically just as awesome as it sounds. We bring people through the city of Atlanta. They're eating, they're walking, learning about the history of the city. And
how are we doing? Are we walking? Or
we're
in a car or a bus?
Only do walking tours. Our strategy is that everybody sees Atlanta by car. I mean, frankly, we're all in our cars way too much. We want to get people out of our cars, walking the streets, seeing the city, looking at the beautiful street art that there is in this place, all of this amazing architecture.
So what's a typical walking tour kind of route? How good of shape do I have to be in to do this?
We've had a 93-year-old lady do our tour, so I think if you're younger than 93, you'll be fine. Okay. We've had people who have come out with double knee surgery, and they come and do the tour. It's all easy, flat walking ground. Our tour is about 1.7 to 2 miles
long. But there's
long.
Stops.
Stops all throughout.
It's not a sprint.
It's not a sprint. And it's usually, around 2 to 2.5 to 3 hours long. We offer actually two types of products. So we offer Atlanta Food Walks, which are food tours where we're eating and walking, and then we also offer Atlanta history tours, which are just straight history.
No eating. Just bring your own food.
Come along with us, and at the end we're going to show you some great places to have lunch afterwards. But all of our experiences are in downtown Atlanta.
Then how are you defining downtown?
So downtown is historic downtown. So historic downtown is actually basically from Castleberry Hill to the other side of Old Fourth Ward. Mm-hmm. So we're not getting into Midtown. I mean, we're in the real what is today. I mean, this is historic downtown Atlanta.
Right.
So we do our downtown Southern Food Walk. We tell the story of how Martin Luther King Jr. was a foodie, and we try essential Southern cuisine on this tour. So we actually go to 7 different restaurants, try 15 tastings over a 3.5-hour time period. It has been rated by National Geographic as the top tour in the city, was named by the Sydney Herald Sun as one of the 53 best food experiences in the world. And they were comparing us to Italy. And I got to admit, I mean, Italy is pretty darn fantastic. So that was amazing. We have a tour in Grant Park. It's our Grant Park Past and Future Food Walk. We do 12 tastings at 5 different restaurants. And on that tour, we're telling the story of how Atlanta is a city built on food. And then on our history tour side, we have our essential Atlanta history tour, which is in the King Historic District. We actually are the only tour company in the city that is partnering with the King Center, the National Park Service, and we also have approval from the King Estate to share the story of Dr. King living in this neighborhood. So, of course, everybody goes to the King Center and they go to the National Park area, but we really are taking people to places they've never seen before, like the elementary school where Dr. King went to school. We're showing the people who influenced him. We take them past Dr. King's office. So we're really kind of exploring these hidden gems in Atlanta.
And when you get to walk the steps that the people that you're spotlighting walked, and you see the things that they saw, it gives you a different perspective on kind of what they felt and what they thought, right? It gives a richer feeling and more kind of robust understanding of what they went through in order to share the story that they did.
absolutely. You know, it's interesting because we frequently have locals on our tour. In fact, I'd say that 50% of our customer base is locals. You know, you would think, oh, well, a tour company, everybody coming as visitors. But no, we do a lot of locals. And we get people all the time who say, I've lived in Atlanta for 30 years.
Right, I never even
35
knew.
Years. Right. Haven't seen any of these things. Haven't been to any of these places. Mm-hmm. We get a lot of people who say, I was scared to go through downtown Atlanta, and they come with us and they're like, wow, there is so much here. And that sense of richness is so important because one of our real abiding philosophies is we believe that Atlanta changed the world. You know, we talk about cities like Boston and Washington, D.C. and New York, and somehow Atlanta gets lost in the shuffle. Mm-hmm. But the story of Atlanta is so critical, so important, and it's one that even people who have lived here for a really long time don't know. And so we're really proud and passionate about telling this story.
And I think Atlanta is unique in that it is so diverse and that the downtown area really encompasses that diversity in ways that different parts of the city don't.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one thing that's wonderful and also fascinating is that we have the opportunity to tell stories that really can't be told anywhere else. I mean, we were the headquarters of the civil rights movement. We were the headquarters of a lot of the Civil War as well. And so we have the opportunity in this city to tell stories that literally can't be told anywhere else. And some of that is being lost. And it's kind of sad, honestly. I don't know if you've ever gone into the neighborhood surrounding the King Center. That neighborhood really needs money. It needs tourism. It needs people going in there. And we are proud to be bringing people into this area because, you know, there's so many economic development companies in the city or, you know, economic development agencies who are spending a ton of money putting in street art, you know, building in new houses or building in new buildings. But at the end of the day, you need people to see that stuff. You Right. need people to buy into that area. And that's what we do. You know, we're not trying to revitalize these areas. We're trying to bring people to see the revitalized areas.
Right. We had last week on the folks from Newport who are
absolutely
are bought a bunch of the older hotels and a lot of the buildings in the south downtown area. And they just opened, I think last week was their pop-up.
It's this Thursday. Right. We actually are, I was just recently on another panel with the people at Newport because we are the only walking tour company in the city that goes through south downtown.
Right.
So
you've seen that firsthand, what they're trying to do.
We do. And we strongly support Newport and what they are doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think at the end of the day, Newport has a lot of work to do. But in the meantime, we're going to be out there showing people how incredible and awesome South Downtown
is. Well, it's a symbiotic relationship. You need them to have stuff so that your walking tour has stuff to tour.
Well, you know what's amazing, though? One of people's favorite spots on our tour, it's a parking lot. I mean, if you look at it, I swear to you, it's a parking lot. And people tell us all the time that they are just amazed by this spot because this spot, this parking lot, is where all of the bootlegging dens in the city were back in the 1920s. In the 1920s, Atlanta had more bootleggers than New Orleans did. Atlanta was the prime bootlegging headquarters.
We've always been good at logistics, supply chain.
We're good at alcohol, too, which I know that's your next guess, right? I mean, I think and people love that, being able to see this parking lot and recognize.
And seeing it in a new way now.
And seeing it in a new way and recognize that, you know, long ago, there was a whole lot of history that's been lost here.
So how can we help you? What do you need more of?
I need more guests. Y'all come on mm-hmm. out and take our tour. You know, the thing is, as any small business we've grown so rapidly, but we're constantly thinking about how do we get more people out to us? And one thing that I think is difficult in the tourism industry is we have a tendency to be very inwardly focused. So I, of course, focus on selling our products through TripAdvisor and Yelp and all of the obvious things. But sometimes I forget about the fact that, hey, there's a lot of people here in Atlanta who might be interested in what we're doing, like listeners of Business Radio X, because what we are doing applies to everybody. You know, we want locals to come out and take our tours. We think we have an incredible city, and we show it in a really, really fun and exciting way.
Yeah. Have you partnered with the schools? Because I would think that the schools, this is a great field trip for the kids.
We do. We do some work with schools. Actually, we do a lot with the colleges, more than schools necessarily, just because most schools have budget limitations. But we do a lot with colleges. Very frequently, we are doing not necessarily field trips, but like group events for colleges where they bring out, you know, students. We do a lot with companies. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about it, a company like Deloitte in the summertime, they have interns. And these interns go to Deloitte. And it's not like they just have to be interested in Deloitte. They have to sell the city of
Atlanta. Are you familiar with Deloitte?
I am.
They're there a lot. Well, no. I don't know how much free time they have to go do walking tours.
Well, no, I mean, well, see, I, you know, my background, right? I, too, am an, I'm a former attorney. And when I was a summer intern, you know, we were working. But
what better give them kind of a 360 view of the city they're coming into to work, right?
Absolutely. And you kind of are selling them and saying, hey, look, Atlanta is this incredible place. And we basically help companies do that. So we do a lot with companies, you know, Coca-Cola, UPS, IG, all of these companies are our clientele as well.
So if somebody wanted to learn more, go on a tour, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Absolutely. So they can check out unexpectedatlanta.com. They can also, which you'll see Atlanta History Tours as well as Atlanta Food Walks. They can also call us directly at 470-223-2203. And we're happy to get them on a tour. We do private tours. We do public tours. We run around 10 to 15 tours every week. So you can join us anytime.
So if I wanted to put my own private group together for a party or something, I can call you and then you'll curate it and we'll kind of make our own thing?
Well, so we don't do custom tours, but we absolutely offer private tour experiences. So we basically have a number of different options for private tours, and then you're basically able to choose one of those options, and we do groups from as small as 10 people up to 170 people.
Wow.
So we kind of do as much as you want, as little as you want. And we, you know, the one thing we always promise is that you're going to see the unexpected side mm-hmm. of Atlanta, but you're also going to have a fabulous time in our city.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Hang with us. One more guest. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, the headliner, Scott Russ, former recovering attorney with Bedlam Vodka. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
So you learn anything there? You got a little diversity, you got a little unexpected Atlanta tours.
And I'm just here talking about booze now.
No, this is the cherry on top.
Okay. And it's supposed to be something before liquor, never. Anyway.
So tell us about Bedlam. How did that get going?
How much time do I have? So as you mentioned, I am a recovering attorney. I'd practiced for about 11, 12 years, something like that. And, I had kind of burned out a little bit, had reached, I felt, the end of my professional limits. And, I had a friend of mine, a good friend from law school, and he was kind of at the same place. He had a firm that he was selling, and I was winding my firm down, selling to my partner. And we ended up having lunch, and we just talked about everything. Talked about, you know, what passion was there for us to get into law in the first place. What was it about it that we enjoyed, and what do we do now? and we had this overwhelming passion to make something. We'd been in service for so long. We wanted to get into manufacturing of some kind. We wanted to make a product.
Mm-hmm.
But we had no idea what we wanted to do. I had been making beer for a long time in my garage
so that was a hobby.
It was a hobby. And it was interesting because, I'd been making beer. The law in North Carolina changed a little bit to allow for home distilling. And so I had this family recipe of sorts. I know I'm kind of jumping.
A beer recipe?
No, this was a liquor recipe.
A liquor.
So several years ago, there was a family reunion, and I got a chance to sit down with grand relatives and great grand relatives and talk with them. And I just basically cornered them at a table and said, I want you to tell me all the stories that you never told us. Like, I want to know who went to jail. I want to know, you know, all the stuff that my parents and, you know, nobody would tell us.
The stuff that's not on the 23andMe.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And so we did this really deep dive, and I've got all these people around me that I think collectively throughout my childhood and my youth, I probably hadn't spoken with them 2 or 3 hours altogether.
Right.
And we sat down, we had this amazing conversation, 2 or 3 hours of just, you know, lots of crosstalk, them talking to each other about history and no, that's not right. It was this person and no, they shot this person or what, you know, whatever the crazy family histories. And it kept going further and further back. And we started talking about how, you know, half the family immigrated from Ireland and what they were doing in the famine and this really interesting tale sort of emerged where during the famine, it was a devastating period in Ireland's history.
Right.
Between 1845 and 1849, potatoes were gone, wheat, barley, corn, rye, every other agricultural crop that they were growing was affected as well. People were starving. It was bad. And so both legally and illegally, they started to look for grain that they could import. There were tax laws that were in place that prevented grain from being imported. For whatever reason, the crown only wanted grain coming out of Ireland, even during the worst agricultural disaster that it had really seen. So they started looking for anything and everything they could bring in to eat, but also to make poteen, which is sort of their moonshine. Poteen is the building block for whiskey. And poteen was a very culturally relevant thing. It kind of smoothed the rough patches of a very hard day. And it was a hard life. It was not easy back then. There wasn't a whole lot of social media to distract us back then. So my family, being part of this group in Ireland.
So they were farmers.
They were farmers. And they started bringing in rice, amongst other grains, but primarily rice from southern Europe. And they hit upon this novel idea to make poteen out of rice. And even after the famine lifted, they were using rice as an adjunct grain, as a supplemental grain, sometimes as a complete grain bill of rice to make poteen. And even after the famine lifted, they continued to make this way. They immigrate to the United States towards the end of the 19th century. They come in to the United States up north and find that as an Irish immigrant family, they were not very welcome. And there weren't a whole lot of farming jobs that were available. Mm-hmm. So they migrated to the south and they put down roots here in Georgia and in Alabama and lived for several decades without distilling, without, you know, having to repeat this process because, alcohol was legal prior to Prohibition. It was readily available.
And so then, they had the recipe, but then they just got jobs and they worked.
Well, I mean, they weren't distillers by trade necessarily.
This was just something they did.
Well, it was something that, most families did.
Right.
And at that point when the Prohibition and the Depression overlapped, it gave them the perfect opportunity to start distilling again.
To bring it back.
Exactly. Because to be frank, the northern appetite for alcohol during Prohibition went unabated. I mean, it didn't matter if it was a constitutional prohibition or not. They wanted alcohol. And the South, as we spoke earlier, even here in Atlanta, especially in Atlanta, they were in a perfect position to produce the alcohol and to sell it up north. And that, for a lot of Southern families, put food on the table, put money in pockets.
During the Depression,
right. That overlap. And so even before the Depression, just during Prohibition in and of itself. So they revived the recipe for a brief period of time, stopped because the association with bootlegging and organized crime, I think, was a little too much for them to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
The illegality of it here was different than in Ireland. So they stopped. And for all intents and purposes, the recipe died.
So it died for, what's that now? You're in the 40s now? 30s?
Early 30s.
Right. So now?
70 plus years. And
here comes Scott.
Here comes Scott. Thirsty.
He is at the reunion and he's like, does anyone still have that recipe?
Yeah. I said, forget about that. Let's go back to that topic about the Irish rice poutine. But I mean, it wasn't so much a recipe as it was this concept. And I thought it was very fascinating. The whole conversation was very fascinating. And then, you know, I took this information back home with me.
And you Google, how hard is it to make this?
Pretty much. I Google, how legal is it at that point?
So legal was first because you're a lawyer.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Entrepreneurs would have went, how easy?
Right.
Worried about the legal later. We'll figure that out later.
When the law changed, and I did figure that out later. And so I bought up a hobby still and started to make it. And to fast forward through a little bit of it, I presented one of my business partners, Brandon, who was a law school classmate of mine, with this recipe.
Right. So you both bailed on law and now you're looking for another thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then you stumble upon this idea and kind of to reboot this recipe from back hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. And to modify it from a poutine into a vodka. It tastes better that way.
Right. Did you try other things other than vodka, or it was the shortest leap to get from poutine to vodka?
I mean, I have since then tried other things, but you know, this was all sort of born out of the family recipe or the family idea.
And so vodka's in the neighborhood or closer to the neighborhood?
To understand your question better, it was the shortest leap. Mm-hmm. It kind of happened by accident on purpose. I just ramped up the ABV on the
ABV,
alcohol by volume,
right?
Coming off the still to a level that would classify the end product as a vodka.
So how many did you have to taste before you're like, okay, then other people can taste this?
I do not recall. I think I'm legally prohibited from admitting.
How it was one or two.
It was one or two.
Right. So then you found a recipe that you liked.
I did, and
you're like, hey, I think we can do this.
Yeah, I think this is it, and it was really unique. I mean, it was not like anything that
it tasted different.
It did,
but it's still under the vodka kind of.
So the way it's distilled would characterize it as a vodka, but it has, you know, a complexity. It has a mouthfeel. It has all these qualities and characteristics
that's unusual for a typical vodka. Now, how did the name Bedlam come about?
We kind of knew we had a different product, and we wanted to come into the market as a disruptor.
And Bedlam kind of symbolizes that.
It did. But even more so, to be historically relevant, there is a town in Ireland, in northwestern Ireland, called Gortahork. Gortahork in Gaelic means field of corn. It was this big agricultural center up there. 1870, 1880, the English landowners were going through Ireland and evicting farmers because the land was very rich in limestone. It had more value of what was in the soil than what grew out of it. And they were literally going through and displacing whole towns without a care of where these families who had been there for generations, where they went. They got to Gortahork and tried this. And I don't know if Gortahork had heard about what was going on and they were ready, or they just decided to go
enough
crazy.
Enough is enough, right?
Yeah, and they rioted. And that became the riot was so massive. The troops that were there to displace them ran away. The proxy that was there for the English landowners went back and said, you've lost Gortahork. You're not getting that. And it was as they were running away, they proclaimed that this was Bedlam, that this was pure Bedlam. That's now the Bedlam Bridge, little beautiful cul-de-sac with patio homes in Gortahork is known as Bedlam. And that was the Bedlam riot. And we thought this sort of fits our
right
mantra.
And then so now you have it's a full-blown distillery.
We founded the distillery in October of 2016. Our product launched June 1st of 2017.
And where is it located?
The distillery is in Durham, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And we launched in North Carolina in June of 2017 and came to Georgia in October of 2017.
And is there a distillery here as well, or this is
no distillery here?
Only in North Carolina.
Yeah, the only location that we have right now is in Durham.
So here you're doing distribution and kind of is this the headquarters here where you're?
No, but this was the first state that we went into outside of North Carolina, and this has been Atlanta has been a primary focus of marketing efforts and. Atlanta is an incredibly influential city from a culinary perspective.
A lot of bootlegger history here, you didn't know that. It's common knowledge now.
I learned that about 15 minutes ago.
Exactly. You can leverage that in your marketing now.
People of Atlanta.
So now in North Carolina, you do tours. It's the whole
– We do.
It's the real deal there.
We actually December 1st we renovated a little bit of our distillery to include tours,
tastings,
absolutely. And the law, hopefully, fingers crossed, knock on wood, is going to change again June 1st or July 1st to allow for expanded tastings and expanded tours. But yeah, I mean, we give people the full history. We give people the full science lesson behind why ours is different and why ours is better. And then they get a little sample.
And then here in Atlanta, it can be found at liquor stores and the usual
bars liquor stores, and stuff. Bars, if they don't have it, if you want to try it, go to your local liquor store. They should have it. If your local watering hole does not, ask them to bring it in.
There you go. And then if somebody wanted to learn more of the website.
Absolutely. BedlamVodka.com. We got lots of recipes. We got events coming up.
Any events here in Atlanta?
I believe we are going to be part of the Atlanta Food and Wine Show. I can't
coming
remember.
Up. There's a lot of food events.
There are. And we like to be part of those as much as we can.
Okay, good.
Music and food.
That's your favorite things.
Yep.
So far cry from being a lawyer, right?
Yeah, comment was made earlier. This is the hardest job I've ever had, but it's the job that I love the most.
That's right. You get fired up waking up every morning.
Absolutely.
Huh? All right, Scott. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. Once again, it's bedlamvodka.com for more information.
Yep, that's it.
Good stuff. Well, thank you, and thanks to all of our guests. This is Lee Cantor for Sanjay Torre. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.